Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, new book outlines the potential for conflict between the United States and China, calls for the release of detained Vietnamese bloggers, and Khmer Rouge-era graves uncovered. We have this and more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. One of Australia's most experienced foreign policy experts says the United States has no choice but to share power with China in Asia. Professor Hugh White says the failure to make the right choice in Washington is to risk a catastrophic war. He says there are clear signs of growing rivalry between the two powers, including in China's incursion into the South China Sea. Professor White has outlined his arguments in a new book called The China Choice. Karen Snowden has this report.
Hugh White is a former intelligence analyst, prime ministerial advisor, and author of the Australian Government's Defence White Paper in 2000. In his latest book, he outlines the choices China, and in particular the United States, face if they are to coexist with a new strategic balance. With the re-emergence of China as a major economic power, Hugh White says it's not surprising it expects other power as well. He says the US is resisting China's rise, and rivalry is escalating between the two.
And when we saw, for example, Barack Obama's speech in Canberra last year, that was a very clear statement that America does not intend to make any space for China at all. China pushes back and the rivalry escalates.
As evidence, Hugh White points to China's naval build-up and Barack Obama's refocusing on the Asia-Pacific in his pivotal speeches last year, and even China's incursions into the South China Sea.
Neither the US or China really have vital interests in the South China Sea, but they are both very conscious that how that issue plays out will be a kind of a test case for who's the most dominant power, who's the primary power in Asia. These are the areas where that kind of rivalry grows, and these are the areas where there's a risk, not a certainty, but a serious risk, that as rivalry grows, a clash could occur, the clash could grow to a war, the war could become a nuclear war if the two sides aren't very careful. This is a risk we have to be very conscious of.
Hugh White says in responding to the challenge to its leadership, the US has three choices: to withdraw from Asia, to push back, or thirdly, the one he supports, to work out a cooperative power-sharing arrangement with China in the Asia-Pacific. It's a view former Australian Prime Minister Paul Keating agreed with as he launched the book.
The great state needs strategic space, and if they are not provided some, they will take it. I have long held the view that the future of Asian stability cannot be cast by a non-Asian power, especially by the application of US military force. There is no chance that China will simply go away and that things as now will keep on as they have been.
Paul Keating says China's ambitions must be accommodated, but Asia will be more stable and peaceful with a US presence. For its part, Australia relies on China economically and looks to its US ally for security. Hugh White says Australia can't act as an intermediary between the two, but should let its views be known.
And I think the critical test for Australia at the moment is, can we develop a clear idea of how we think Asia ought to evolve, how we think the US and China should get on, what would be in our interests, and then go to Washington and Beijing and sell that vision.
Hugh White's book will continue what's becoming the major foreign policy debate in Australia. Separately, Australia's Defence Minister Stephen Smith was interviewed by Perth Radio. He defended the US alliance and discussed US-China relations.
What we need to do is to make sure that the political relationship, the strategic relationship, the military relationship and the defence relationship grows to the same level, so you don't have what I describe as strategic competition between United States and China.
But Australia's first ambassador to China, Stephen Fitzgerald, wants Australia to take a more independent stance within its alliance with the US. He says recent announcements about expanded access for US Marines and warships is not sending the right signals.
And in doing this, it has signed up to what is, in effect, a new emerging military alliance that the United States is putting together. And despite the denials, it is clearly aimed at China. The government should not in any way be associated with that objective, because it's not in our interests to be caught in the middle of the contest between America and China.
The international community is calling for the release of three Vietnamese bloggers who are facing trial for spreading propaganda against the state. The request comes after the mother of one of the bloggers committed suicide by setting herself on fire. We have this story from Zoe Daniel.
Vietnam is a one-party state where there's no independent media, and writing something deemed offensive to the communist government can land you in prison. That may be the fate of bloggers Du Khai, Ambar Saigon and Tha Phong Tan. The trio belong to the outlawed Free Journalists Club. Phil Robertson from Human Rights Watch.
What is fundamentally wrong here is that they're doing nothing that that should be a crime. They have been blogging, they've been speaking out freely, and the government doesn't want to hear the criticism, doesn't want to have narratives that they don't approve of, and so they slap them with charges like conducting propaganda against the state. You know, that's what it says in their penal code. I mean, they're not shy about the fact that, you know, this is propaganda. But it's not propaganda. It's free speech, and it should be protected.
The bloggers could face 20 years in jail. One of them, Tha Phong Tan, blogged about corruption in Vietnam's legal system. Last week, Tan's mother set herself on fire. She died on the way to hospital. A friend of the bloggers, lawyer and activist Laquan Quan, says her death was self-immolation.
She burned herself is the ultimate answer and ultimate challenge to the state to say that I kill myself to find for a fair and for more transparent mechanisms, and please release her daughter.
Of late, there's been a stream of political trials and arrests in Vietnam. It's thought the Vietnamese government may be worried that a pro-democracy Arab Spring might reach Asia. Democracy activist Laquan Quan has been arrested 7 times and narrowly missed being arrested again last week.
They came here, they forced me on Saturday morning. They came to my office, they forced me, they brought a car here, and then they tried to push me in with the policeman.
Quan's been speaking his mind for years, but the younger bloggers we spoke to were too frightened to be identified. One writer in Hanoi describes her life.
Being a political blogger in Vietnam can be both interesting and dangerous. It is interesting because maybe because it's dangerous, and because also because you can feel some kind of freedom of expression on the internet, which you cannot find in your real life, in reality. But but the adverse side or the dangerous side of being a political blogger in Vietnam is very obvious. When you are a political blogger in Vietnam, you may face many kinds of harassment from your local authorities, and even from the central or governmental authorities.
As for the political bloggers from the Free Journalists Club, the US Embassy in Hanoi is calling for their release. And last week, US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton raised concerns about their incarceration. But what about Australia?
It can't just be a one-off discussion on 1 or 2 days. The issue of human rights has to infuse Australia's relationship with Vietnam. And it's important that the diplomats, not only in Hanoi but also in Canberra, make that so.
Human rights groups believe the outcome of the bloggers' trial is predetermined. It's not a matter of if they go to prison, but for how long.
A mass grave thought to hold the bones of Khmer Rouge victims has been uncovered in northwest Cambodia. The grave contains the skeleton remains of at least 20 people, some with their leg bones still bound by rope. The shallow grave was uncovered by local villagers clearing the land for cultivation. But the discovery serves as a reminder that millions of Cambodians are still waiting for justice in a country where the painful memories, like the bones, remain close to the surface. Bill Bainbridge has the story. Monsoonal rains sweep Cambodia every year, shifting soil and what lies just beneath. That makes it relatively common to uncover the bones of Khmer Rouge victims. At least 1.7 million people were either killed or died of starvation during the brutal regime that ruled Cambodia in the mid-1970s. Yuk Chang has dedicated his life to documenting the Khmer Rouge crimes. He says even after more than 30 years has passed, their haunting presence is still all around.
It's difficult for any of us living in Cambodia to escape this haunting memory because, you know, after years of flood and rains, you see the boat appear on the ground and you close in the rice, when you walk across the rice field, you see this thing. And, you know, even though it's without tear, no more tear to drop, but the bone sort of want to speak, still can speak to you.
Yuk Chang's organisation, the Documentation Centre of Cambodia, located this and many other sites near the Angkor Wat temples back in 1998. He says, based on interviews and geological surveys, they estimate around 35,000 people were killed in the area, often with great brutality.
The gravesite was a prison, you know, so there's a prison in that site. It's called Phnom Thong Bat Prison. And usually the Khmer Rouge would bury the prisoner nearby the prison site. So it was a prison there, which is located in the middle of the pagoda, and victims were brought there and detained and then executed and buried nearby site.
One prison chief has been put on trial. Kang Kek Yu, or Doik as he is also known, directed the S21 prison at Tul Sleng in Phnom Penh. And 2 years ago, he was sentenced to 35 years in jail. But Yuk Chang says he led just one of the 196 jails operated by the Khmer Rouge.
We leave it to the court to decide, but us, we're not judged. But the court has a complete document about the whole prison system in this country, including mass grave location, potential witness, local documents, related materials, name of perpetrators, name of prison chief, you name it.
Claire Duffy has been observing the Khmer Rouge Tribunal for the Open Society Justice Initiative. She says it's just not feasible to put everyone who may have had a role in the Khmer Rouge killings on trial.
Obviously, in all of the war crimes tribunals, who is prosecuted by them is something that is a matter of discretion, and obviously these courts cannot, nor are they designed to, go after everyone or every level of perpetrator that commits these kinds of offences. So they do have to draw a line in the sand somewhere.
But it remains a controversy just where that line is drawn. While no one is advocating that low-level prison chiefs or guards be prosecuted, two international judges have now resigned from the tribunal after being frustrated in their attempts to investigate former senior members of the Khmer Rouge. A third judge, American Mark Harmon, will take over the role in the coming weeks, and Claire Duffy says he must be allowed to freely go about his work.
Been marred by allegations of political interference for at least 2 years now, and there have been a number of resignations of international judges in that office, two of them in the last 9 months. So yes, the big question is, with the arrival of this new judge, will he be left to do what he needs to do, which is to genuinely investigate the allegations against those five individuals.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or past editions, stay tuned. I'll be giving out the email address and website towards the end of the program. In India, there is renewed focus on the practice of child labor, following important curbs in places like the United States and other Western countries on hand-embroidered textiles known as zari. The heart of the mostly home-based zari industry in West Bengal is where many poor villagers rely on their income generated by their work. Child labor may be banned in India, but around a third of the country's zari workers are aged between 6 and 14. Shekhar Ziri Rahman has the story.
A Bollywood tune warps out of a makeshift embroidery workshop in the predominantly Muslim village of Beldanga, about 50 kilometers south of Calcutta. With needles and threads, 42-year-old Mrs. Manwara Begum and her three children are busy stitching shining beads onto ornate fabric. The youngest worker is Mrs. Begum's school-age 12-year-old son, Asif Ghazi. I'm a grade 6 student and I top the class. The day I go to school, I do zari work up to 4 hours, and the day my school is closed, I work for 14 to 15 hours. I earn about 1500 rupees a month. This money is a big help to my family. In most zari workshops in Beldanga, children between 8 and 14 are painstakingly stitching beads to the fabric with their tiny hands. They are just some of the estimated 20 to 50 million child laborers in different industries across India. Like Asif, Rukhsana Khatun works on zari along with her mother and two sisters at home when not attending her school. The 10-year-old says she has no time to play because she needs the income. Parents marry off the daughters early in the village, and zari work helps pay for the dowry and other wedding costs. From the age of 6, I stopped playing and began doing zari work. My eldest sister worked from the age of 6, saved money, and bore all expenses of her marriage. I am also saving part of my income for my marriage in future. Poverty was rampant in Beldanga until some years ago. Most people worked as landless farm laborers or migrated to the cities in search of other menial work. But with the introduction of zari work in the late 1990s, that situation began to change. Zari worker Manwara Begum argues the industry ensures a better, safer future for the villagers, especially women and children. Even the husband fails to support family, the wife can single-handedly earn enough to raise her children without much difficulty. The zari industry has indeed brought never-seen-before empowerment to the girls. More than 90% of West Bengal's estimated 1 to 2 million zari workers are from the disadvantaged Muslim community. Aziz Mubarki, a Muslim community leader, says he finds nothing wrong with poor parents pushing their children into the industry early.
You see, Muslims constitute 33% of West Bengal's population. But then only around 2% of government jobs in the state are held by Muslims. Now my point is, if one has to earn his livelihood finally as a zari worker, then what's the harm if he begins learning the skill early in his childhood?
But Sanjay Bora from the rights group Save the Children India says the children in the zari industry are victims of abuse.
Practice of child labor is clear violation of the child's individual rights. Given a choice, which child would opt out for work or going out, playing, hanging around with friends or watch TV? So all children want to have fun. They do not work by choice but are forced to do so by their parents.
And Sanjay Bora argues that the children of poor families will only really improve their economic lot through education.
Poverty cannot be an excuse for keeping children away from school. These poor parents fail to understand that education is the only way for their children to better their living standard and move up the social ladder. By denying the children their rights to education, the parents of these zari worker children are doing them an injustice.
The International Anti-Poverty Agency, ActionAid, has sounded the alarm after four Sydney men bound for Bangladesh were arrested on suspicion of being in possession of large quantities of steroids. The drug, Oradexin, which is intended for use in the cattle industry to fatten cows, is widely used in the sex industry in Bangladesh. ActionAid launched an awareness campaign 2 years ago calling for the drug to be regulated and for its use in brothels to be stopped. Richard Erwart speaks to Archie Law, the executive director of ActionAid Australia.
I suppose something like Oradexin is really pushed by brothel owners onto the sex workers themselves, because it makes women put on weight. It makes them look plumper, and that's what men who are using the services of sex workers prefer. So they're taking a cow steroid to make themselves more attractive to men.
And I gather also in cases where there are underage girls working in these brothels that it can make them look older.
Exactly, because some of the women, some of the girls who are working in these brothels, and I mean, just to paint a brief picture, we're talking about brothels where thousands of women work. The biggest brothel of the world is in Bangladesh. It can make a 12-year-old look like they're 15, 16, and again, that makes that a more attractive proposition to a male.
Now, the process, as you've described, is plainly bad enough, but this drug, I gather, poses far more serious dangers to the sex workers than simply being in the industry in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Look, there's all sorts of side effects that we understand take place as a result of the use of Orodexin by people. They include diabetes, high blood pressure, skin rashes, headaches, kidney failure. It's also highly addictive, and it can result in premature death.
So what, if anything, are the authorities in Bangladesh doing to stop this?
Look, very little at the moment. I suppose one of the problems is that the use of the drug isn't regulated, and it's a legal substance for what it's meant to be used for as far as fattening up cows. What we're really asking is that the government of Bangladesh does regulate the use of this drug, and women themselves are very well organised. The sex worker community in Bangladesh is very organised, and they're pushing for these sorts of issues as well, in addition to the other issues as far as trafficking, the use of children by brothel owners. So there's a big push coming in Bangladesh itself.
So as far as the particular issue of Orodexin is concerned, I mean, do the authorities in Bangladesh even acknowledge that there is a problem, that these girls are being exploited in this way?
Not to our understanding, no. That's part of the problem. And, you know, if anything comes out of this appalling case, it's an increased awareness of the catastrophe that looms in the lives of sex workers in Bangladesh as a result of the use of this cow steroid.
Now, in the light of the arrests of four Sydney men on suspicion of trafficking in steroids, I mean, how concerned are you that Australia is a source of supply?
Deeply concerned, firstly, that Australians are exploiting vulnerable people in Bangladesh in this way. What it does do, if the allegations are correct, it certainly opens up a lot of questions about where the source of supply is coming from, and if Australia is a big supplier of Orodexin to Bangladeshi brothels, that's obviously something that the authorities in Australia need to look at as well. There's obviously the legal perspective of what can be taken out of the country, but there's also the moral and the ethical issues that need to be confronted by Australia as well, as far as the destination of this drug and what it's being used for.
Now, we've talked about the Action Aid campaign that you've launched, calling for the drug to be regulated. Now, that, I presume, that campaign was essentially focused on Bangladesh in the first instance, but plainly now, as you've indicated, there needs to be an awareness campaign in Australia too, because perhaps governments are not aware that this kind of trafficking is going on and what it could lead to.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what we're monitoring at the moment, as far as to get more details on this case as well, because it's very early stages, as I'm sure you and the listeners appreciate. We need to track the case itself and to get a sense of what is the problem in Australia, and then what can we do in Australia as concerned citizens to ensure that supply is stopped from here.
Just to put a slightly more positive spin on the situation, I mean, the Action Aid campaign over the last couple of years, you believe you've had some success, you're assisting in some way to help these girls in Bangladesh?
Well, I think so. We're doing a lot of work with sex workers in helping them to organise. And they're building their sense that they have power when they're working together. And, you know, the issues I've mentioned, such as what they can do to stop women being trafficked into working in brothels, how do they stamp out underage women working as sex workers? How do they work on engaging with their government and forcing their government to follow their own law? And we are seeing small step by small step, there are real advances being taken there, and the future does really lie with how the women are able to organise themselves and confront the challenges they face. And I think Australians have a big role in supporting them on that journey.
That was Archie Law, the Executive Director of ActionAid Australia, speaking with Richard Erwart. And finally on the program, it was described as a petty robbery that went wrong. But two Thai men have been sentenced to life for the murder of an Australian woman on the resort island of Phuket. Michelle Smith from Perth died when she tried to resist a robbery in June. Observers say the Thai men pleaded guilty to the charges to avoid a possible death sentence. Meanwhile, Thai authorities have been trying to assure tourists that Phuket is safe. Tom Nightingale has the story.
Sirisak Suwanacho is aged 26 and has been jailed for life for stabbing Michelle Smith in Phuket. He confessed and was then photographed with an imitation cardboard knife in a public police reenactment of the stabbing. Another man, 37-year-old Surin Taptong, confessed to being involved and riding a motorbike away from the scene and getting rid of the knife. Phuket Gazette journalist Chris Husted is originally from Brisbane.
The international media coverage is what really ramps up the pressure. And if you have any indication of how many members of the press were at the court, it's just staggering. It's the international media coverage, it's the presence and the damage to the tourism reputation of Thailand that the high end of the government are really worried about.
Did they get the sentences they did partly because of the notoriety of the case?
Possibly. Surin, the motorbike rider, now he seems to be aggrieved, won't speak too much about it, but he has pleaded guilty to a charge that seems very inappropriate. But by doing so, he is not going to be found guilty of that charge and hence cannot be handed down a death sentence.
So you're saying the men pleaded guilty to avoid the risk of a death sentence?
Yes, it's not coded, it's not in the statutes, but there is the one fundamental tenet is if there's a death sentence as a possible penalty, if you plead guilty, the judge will commute it to a life sentence.
Chris Husted says authorities have made the case a priority. He also says many more CCTV cameras are being set up in busy spots. But he says the local police force is undermanned.
There certainly is a question of would this tragedy have happened regardless of extra police patrols? It was a bag snatching gone wrong. It's a tourism destination and it's a bag snatching gone wrong.
The lawyer for both men has indicated they won't appeal the sentences.
And with that report from Tom Nightingale, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you'd like to listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. We'd also like to hear from you to find out what you think of the program. Our email address is pcj@pcjmedia.com. Once again, pcj@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Parent wishing you well, hoping to see you again in 7 days' time for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Until then, bye-bye.